This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now that President Obama's been reelected, it's clear that at least the president won't try to repeal Obamacare. But with all the political mudslinging about the Affordable Care Act, the details sort of got lost, didn't they? Do you actually know what the law does for you? And just as importantly, what it doesn't do? What changes to your health care kick in on January 1st? What major changes kick in 2014 and thereafter? How are the insurance exchanges going to work, for example? Will insurance actually be more affordable than it is today? Will your doctor still take your insurance? Can you design your own health insurance? And if more people have insurance, will there be enough doctors to go around? Take Texas, for example. It's the most uninsured state in the nation and already has a critical shortage of primary care doctors. And they prepared for even more people with insurance cards, are they? Could nurse practitioners, community health centers, or so-called minute clinics in your local drugstore fill in the gaps? How the changing healthcare landscape is affecting you and what to expect from the Affordable Care Act? That's what we're going to be talking about this hour, and you're invited to join in. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I, or join our website at sciencefriday.com. Ask questions there. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Mark Siegel is the author of The Inner Pulse, Unlocking the Secret Code of Sickness and Health. He's also Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center here in New York. He's Medical Director of Doctor Radio and the Medical Correspondent for Fox News. He's with us in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, good to be with you.
Thank you. Dr. David Blumenthal is a professor at Harvard Medical School. He's also Chief Health Information and Innovation Officer at Partners Healthcare and former U.S. National Coordinator for Health Information Technology under President Obama. He joins us from WBUR. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Great to be here.
Thank you. Margaret Flinter is a Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of Community Health Center, Inc. That's headquartered in Middletown, Connecticut. She's a family nurse practitioner there. She's also the co-host, along with Mark Maselli, of Conversations on Healthcare, a weekly radio show about health reform and innovations. And she joins us from Connecticut. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Flint.
Thanks so much for having us, Ira.
Let me begin with you. You've been keeping tabs on the law as it kicks in. What changes are already in place, and what changes are set to happen as the clock turns to January 1st?
Well, the big changes that are already in place are the pipeline has been increased. Certainly the National Health Service Corps has been increased. The number of community health centers and their capacity to care for people, sort of speaking directly to the issues you referenced at the beginning, Ira, we've seen increased capacity there, increased training. The big thing that we're all waiting for, though, and it'll be 2014, not 2013, is the development of the state-based health insurance exchanges. And this is that new marketplace where people who previously have been uninsured or not been able to get insurance through their employers are able to go and get that insurance. And I hope we're going to talk about qualitatively how that insurance might be better, but also how people who can't afford it will be able to get help in paying for it. And then, of course, we're going to see the advent of more preventive services without copays, being able to keep our children, which has already happened, our children on insurance up to the age of 26, because we know one of the biggest groups in America that were unable to get health insurance were those young people. And I'm sure Dr. Blumenthal will speak to something that is well underway that started even before the Affordable Care Act but is supported in it, and that's the increased use of our electronic health records and technology of all kinds, mobile technology as well as electronic health records, to make care higher quality and safer and more available to people.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Blumenthal, you're based in Massachusetts where you already have these insurance exchanges that that Dr. Flinter was talking about. How do they work? How do you foresee any problems with them state to state?
Well, we do, Ira, have a functioning version of Obamacare here in Massachusetts. It's been in place for 5 or 6 years. We have virtually no uninsured individuals, just a couple of percent. There's a very high level of satisfaction among the population here in Massachusetts with the insurance arrangements under the our version of Obamacare. It does rely on a version of the state health insurance exchange. We call it the connector. And I can tell you from personal experience with patients and with friends that it's very easy to obtain insurance even if you're a poor individual just by going online. We have not suffered appreciably from a shortage of capacity. We have a large number of physicians in Massachusetts, but we don't have a large number of primary care physicians. And we are working here to improve the supply of primary care physicians. But if you look cross-nationally, as the Commonwealth Fund does, at the reported access to care in Massachusetts compared to other states, you'll find that as many people here report having a primary care or a regular physician as do virtually anywhere in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mark Siegel, you've written that Obamacare may be bad for patients and bad for doctors. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a lot of issues here that we should discuss. The first issue, actually, Margaret brought up, which is the National Health Service Corps increasing in numbers and the number of federally funded clinics. I find that interesting that she mentions that because I actually think that's a very good thing, but I don't think that that's anywhere near as a prominent part of this plan as it should be, probably for political reasons. I mean, maybe a lot of people would have liked that. But I think my first point is if the federal government wants to provide more care for poor people or underserved people, they should provide care, and the way to do that is to provide doctors. I have a lot of concerns about the insurance model here because I think it's based on comprehensiveness. Dr. Blumenthal talks about preventive services, but I'm concerned that it's too easy to overuse this type of insurance. Now, that's not Obamacare's fault. We had that problem before this was extended nationally, meaning if you have the insurance card, if you can find the physician to see you, you can go in to see that doctor, even if you don't actually have a medical problem. That costs a lot of money. And if we cover people with pre-existing conditions, which we should do, but we don't differentiate who's paying more. I'm concerned about people that have self-destructive lifestyles that get very ill, and essentially they pay the same premium. I'm glad about covering people up to the age of 26, but a lot of those people would probably prefer a policy that wasn't so comprehensive. So as Obamacare is laid out and more regulations come into play about what kind of insurance is allowed on the state exchange, I'm very concerned about that insurance not having enough options about what you can actually have, not having high enough deductibles, not having high enough copays as a disincentive for overuse of this insurance. I don't like the one-size-fits-all concept here. I think we need more choices. I think physicians in general have a problem taking insurance. I'm a primary care physician. I continue to practice. Dr. Blumenthal said, you know, there's a shortage in Massachusetts. Well, Massachusetts has more great medical schools than anywhere in the country. What's going to be in North Dakota if we have a problem with primary care docs in Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm. But this is what we have. I mean, the point is we have Obamacare, and this is where how are we going to be using it is the question.
Well, and that's why we're discussing it today. I think that patients have to be aware of these realities, that it's not rose-colored glasses. This is the law of the land. It is going to be the law. Both doctors and patients have to learn to work with it. But let me phrase my answer a little differently, Ira, so that I address your question directly. I think we have a major problem with physicians, not just a physician shortage in the United States, but physicians who may decide they don't want to work with this insurance. That presents a problem for patients. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about a patient that says, I have insurance now, but I can't find a doctor or network of doctors to work with it.
Mm-hmm. You know, Ira, if I could...
Margaret, yes.
Yeah, if I could chime in, I come at this from the perspective of having spent virtually my entire career in primary care and in community health centers and caring often for people who had no health insurance, right? So maybe a little bit of a different perspective. And we say we become experts both in primary care and also experts in trying to organize and arrange care for people who don't have insurance. So that calls on you to be as innovative and as efficient and to eliminate as many waits and delays and waste areas as you possibly can because your people have very little to begin with. And so we look at the fact that people have insurance for the first time as hugely important. And of course, we don't want people to overuse. You know, my concern is much more underuse than overuse when it comes to preventive services and the like. But it also means in order to make the best use of the resources we have, the physicians in primary care and the nurse practitioners and others, we've got to look at innovations that make a difference. So we think about things like, what happens when my diabetic needs to be monitored 4 times a year? Do they really need to come into the office, or can we, as I think Mark has suggested, is able to do in his practice, use a combination of email or phone or Skype to help better use the resources we have. What happens when that same diabetic needs to see a specialist? Can we do that through an electronic consult instead of always sending the person? How do we organize care? How do we bring the mental health specialist right into the primary care office instead of having them across town where our patients will have so much trouble getting to them and where there's all sorts of inefficiencies in that system? So it's very exciting to think about, once we level the playing field a little bit, where our efforts don't have to go into trying to scramble to find resources for people, but can be put into the best use of them, I think we're going to see some really exciting advances.
If I could just add a couple of things. This piece of legislation is so comprehensive and includes so many elements that it's easy to lose track of the big picture. It really consists of two bills within a single bill. One is a bill about extending coverage to people who don't have insurance and making those who have insurance more confident in the ability of their insurance to cover them for things they care about being covered for. The other, and often overlooked part of the bill, will make major, major changes in the way healthcare is organized, financed, and delivered. There's virtually no aspect of the delivery system which mm-hmm. isn't touched by this legislation. So you could focus for a while, if you wanted to, on the training provisions, which are important, or the community health center augmentation, which is important. But there are also major changes to the way Medicare will function and the way Medicaid will function that are intended to improve the efficiency of care and the quality of care and the value of care received. Then there are all the coverage-related provisions that include the health insurance exchanges, as well as expansions of Medicaid, as well as guarantees against the termination of coverage by private insurance companies when people get sick and cost too much, as well as the denial of coverage for people who have pre-existing illnesses. It's a very comprehensive piece of legislation, and I think it's very easy to get lost in the details.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get into some of the details when we come back from the break, because there's some specifics I think our listeners are already tweeting us and asking questions about. We're talking with Mark Siegel, Margaret Flinter, and David Blumenthal about the upcoming changes to Obamacare. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the future of healthcare as the Obamacare legislation laws now kick in and start changing things. Actually picking up speed in 2013-2014. I want to bring in another guest, another doctor from Brooklyn. Well, I meant to say actually a few months ago, a doctor from Brooklyn joined us to talk about his dissatisfaction with the healthcare system and how he set out to change it in the New York City area. And joining us now is another doctor with another idea from a different place. He's a longtime practicing physician who's reinventing his practice with the hope of delivering better health care to his patients. Dr. Rob Lampertz is an internist and pediatrician based in Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ari. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Why did you leave your old practice?
Well, basically, I've been practicing for 18 years, and as time has gone on, as a primary care physician, I've found more and more that my attention has been on focusing on things other than the direct patient care, the direct care of my patients. And as you know, just to do the same amount of work, I've had helping my patients, I've had to spend a lot more time dealing with the paperwork, dealing with the details, mm-hmm. submitting data to Medicare and complying with the rules. And I just felt like I was not able to offer as good of care as I wanted to for my patients.
So you've come up with a very streamlined new system for your office. What is your plan? What is your plan?
Well, it's called direct care practice, and essentially it's fairly old-fashioned. It's the patient pays me, and I take care of them, and that's pretty much it. The difference is that it's a $50 plus or minus per month fee for the patient to pretty much get any service that I give, whether it's over the phone, whether it's over the internet, whether it's an office visit, whether it's labs that I do in the office. This just enables me to offer them care in any way that I can do it. I don't have to bring them into the office for them to come in and see me for every little problem. Because in the old system, the only way that I would ever get paid for something was if I actually saw the patient in the office, and the payment was actually not based on what I did, but what I documented. So this just allows me to focus on giving good care for the patient and not have to worry about the financial stuff.
What about if they need hospitalization and things like that?
Well, that would be something above and beyond. That would not be something that would be covered by me. It would be covered by their insurance, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, or whether it's an insurance plan.
So how does your plan differ from what they call concierge medicine? Although concierge medicine is much higher than $50 a month, right?
Yeah, in general, concierge, it's really more definition. Some people do call this kind of a practice concierge, but I like to make the distinction is that my goal is not to offer the leather seats and the first class medicine, you know, the extra bells and whistles that you can get for paying more money. My goal is to offer as good of health care, which a lot of times is doing less, which a lot of times is just answering questions right then and there when they need to be answered. And, you know, patients will a lot of times save up questions for the visit because they know the only time they're ever going to get to interact with me is when they come in and pay for a visit, and so they'll hold on to that. I want my patients to be continually communicating with me. And a concierge does do that, but in general, concierge tends to focus on premium services, and, you know, it can be, you know, 10 times as expensive as what I'm doing, although most of the time it's not. Most of the time it's in the $2,000 to $5,000 per year range.
And what's your view on the Affordable Care Act, on Obamacare?
You know, a lot of folks saw what I did because of the timing as something that was a major comment on the Affordable Care Act. I think the only effect the whole Obamacare thing had on my decision was that it convinced me that I don't think the government's going to fix the problem. There was so much fighting going on, and really the impact that it would actually have on me as a physician wasn't all that much. If anything, as a primary care doctor, I might get actually a little bit more reimbursement through this because a lot of the focus is on primary care. But there is actually also a provision within the Affordable Care Act that talks about direct care practices and allows small businesses to do a contract with a doctor like myself as long as I jump through all the hoops that I need to, and then a high deductible plan, and then they would avoid the fines that would be associated with that. So, you know, for me, actually, that's a benefit of the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act because it allows me to go out and find these businesses, and I can not only give them coverage and allow them to cut their cost or at least control their cost, but I also can do innovative things like, you know, trying to minimize employee absenteeism, do educational programs at the office, at the workplace. You know, I can do whatever I want. Since I'm already paid at the start of the month, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, good. Let me get a follow-up from Mark Siegel. Do you have a comment on
that? I think to one extent, Rob represents and identifies a certain problem here. A busy primary care doctor who may be being paid less, may not, has more tests. He's worrying about whether they're going to get approved. More and more paperwork. He ultimately will decide, not Rob, but he might decide to see more and more patients to keep his bottom line, to keep his office lights on, to keep his practice going. You brought up something in the middle of Rob talking that I think was really crucial, which you may not realize, which is the hospital may decide that they don't want to work with Rob. They may want to work only with people in network that actually take Obamacare. So his solution, not only in terms of hospitalization, but in terms of networks, may be problematic. It may work for him, but he might not find the orthopedist he needs. I got to tell you, in New York City, I'm not going to be able to work like Rob is going to be able to work. I'm not going to have the doctors I need to work with outside of Obamacare. If I say, I'm going to take cash, I'm a great doctor, here's my business solution, I might not have the hospital or the doctors to work with. But within Obamacare, if I didn't have other sources of income, like Fox News, like Dr. Radio, I might find myself seeing more and more patients in a shorter period of time, hiring nurse practitioners. Now, that may be the future here, but that's not exactly the way it was presented to the American public.
All right. Good luck to you, Dr. Lampertz, and we'll keep track of how it works out for you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. We're talking about the future of healthcare. Margaret, let me ask you for some advice here. What was your opinion about what Dr. Lampertz was working on?
Well, I think that one of the common themes that you're hearing here, Ira, is one, a need for innovation, and there's plenty of that out there, and two, a desire for people to be paid for the value they're providing and not just the volume of care that they're churning out. And the third is that for us to do everything that we know needs to be done for patients, to do the best evidence-based healthcare, whether that's at the primary care level or it's at the tertiary medical center, takes a lot of time. And to be honest, it takes a lot more than all of us providers. Mm. You know, we look at the one of the most promising innovations that's not necessarily spelled out in the Affordable Care Act, but it's implicit there, is the use of the team and the primary care team. And my colleagues might disagree with me on whether this is the way it works in their practice. But for us to have our medical assistants be trained to the highest level we can train them so that that which can be done automatically is done automatically, your screenings for cancer, the preventive tests, the assessment of how well controlled your asthma is, screening for depression, that doesn't need to rely on the primary care provider always. That can be done by somebody else, again, eliminating some of that time that is so precious in primary care. So adding to the team nurses who can coordinate the care of patients. When you ask, you know, what's the American public going to see that's different? They're not going to see all of the things that are different because of the Affordable Care Act. But behind the scenes, the intense focus that we're putting on helping people coordinate their care and manage transition. I don't know if you've had the experience of maybe a relative or an elderly parent who's been in the hospital, comes out, doesn't understand anything, everything gets confused, they're back in the hospital in 20 days. The Affordable Care Act takes that head on and says, you know, it's just possible. We can reduce suffering and reduce cost by better care, better quality care, coordinating care more tightly. And so in our primary care teams, you'll find not just the physicians and the nurse practitioners and the medical assistants, but you'll find our primary care nurses really focused on care coordination. And you'll find, thanks to the electronic health record, that they'll have data to use to make that quality better that really I could only dream of when I was first in practice. So a lot of changes.
Let me ask you one thing that people are going to notice, and that's their insurance premiums. Are insurance premiums going to be any cheaper for people through the exchanges? And as a tweet comes in here, says, will I have a choice of what insurance policies I would like to take? These exchanges. If you want to jump in there.
Let me respond to that. There isn't going to be such a thing as Obamacare and being in it or out of it. Mm-hmm. What Obamacare chiefly does on the insurance side is make it possible for people to buy private insurance that is equivalent to what they would get if they had a reasonably complete private insurance plan through their employer. What it does is really enshrines and reinforces and supports the private health insurance market that has existed for 60, 70 years in the United States.
All right, let's go through a practical setup here. It's now 2014, and I can buy my own insurance. What do I do? Do I go online? Do I have to find a broker? Yeah. How does that all work?
So you go on. Let me describe a very practical experience that I witnessed. A friend who developed a brain tumor, didn't have insurance, went online in Massachusetts to the connector, had 10 or 12 choices of different insurance plans, enrolled and had insurance within a couple of weeks. Would have been totally impossible for that person as an individual, not part of a group, to have good, solid private insurance with no restrictions, no exclusions of pre-existing conditions, that and had a choice, not one plan, but multiple plans. The insurance exchanges are going to be required to offer multiple levels of insurance, including a catastrophic plan. There are restrictions on the amount of deductibles, but deductibles are possible. There are restrictions on the amount of that individuals will have to pay out of pocket that are somewhere between 2% and 9% of their income, but there will be premiums paid. So it's a kind of friendly version of the current private insurance market we have. It'll be like going online to buy an airplane ticket or to register or reserve a hotel room with easy comparative data.
What about the states that do not want to create the exchanges? Where do the people of those states go?
So there will be an exchange in every state. It'll either be run by the state or it'll be run by the federal government.
So they'll have a choice of going to the federal government if the state doesn't.
The federal government will have an exchange that will be run under federal auspices that will be available to members of that state. There are also versions of a federal-state partnership that will be possible. State may run part of the exchange, but not all of it.
Can the state compete with the federal government in a different exchange and get a better price? Or can the federal government just, vice versa? Will it be competitive pricing?
Well, there will not be a federal exchange and a state, parallel mm-hmm. state exchange in the same state. There will be one exchange. It'll either be run by the state, it'll be run by the federal government, or it'll be run by a federal-state partnership.
Let me just interrupt and say, we have to pay the bills, too. This is Science Friday from NPR. Okay, let me first go to, because I know that you,
I've been building
Mark
up
Cuban,
some
you've been, yes.
Okay, a couple of comments on what's been said, some of which I think is very inspiring. In terms of the states, what David just said about the exchanges, the one exception right now may be Utah, where they're trying to set up a voucher program, which won't be approved unless they campaign for it and say, look, I want an alternative here to the state or federal exchange. Second point is, I'm concerned, and other critics of this are concerned, that the premiums are going to be too high because there may not be enough choices because these are state exchanges rather than federal exchanges. Third point, I don't really believe that young people who actually constitute most of the uninsured are going to have enough options in terms of catastrophic only. Next point, Margaret's point about quality of care and teams, I love that. I hope it works. I think she made a really brilliant point to bring that up. We have to go in that direction. I'm not against that. The question is, though, can quality of care really be reinforced, as the accountable care organizations are going to try to do, when you consider, my view is, if you're a criminal as a physician ordering too many EKGs, you're going to be a criminal under accountable care organizations trying to fake some paperwork. I hope I'm wrong about that. I hope fraud and abuse is decreased. But her idea of a system of doctors and nurses and care providers that actually don't only have money as a bottom line, but care for the patient, inpatient and outpatient. Now, one final point. Mm-hmm. That may undermine this. You know, the current penalty for readmitting a patient to a hospital if they have the same diagnosis, which ironically would apply today probably to former President George H.W. Bush, who has been readmitted for a recurrent bronchitis. I don't know if his hospital will actually be reimbursed for that because he had that 2 weeks ago. But humor aside, I think that penalty doesn't take into account the problem we have with rural areas where you may not be able to get out of the hospital and get to a primary care doctor. Again, this isn't all Massachusetts. So why should a hospital be penalized for a readmission?
1-800-999-8255. Let me get a quick phone call before the break. I'm Ian in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, please turn down your radio. Turn down your radio. I'm in. Oh, I have to drop them there because let's go to John in Wichita. Hi, John. John, are you there? Oh, we're having trouble with the phones today. Well, his question was how will the exchanges be affected by union contracts that are already in existence? Will they be grandfathered? How is that going to work, David?
If you have insurance currently, sometimes people have insurance through their unions. Sometimes they have them through their employers. If you have insurance currently and you want to keep it, you will be able to keep it. That's one of the key mm-hmm. tenets of the Affordable Care Act. But insurance obtained through the workplace will continue to be obtained in the same way that it already has. That is, it'll be a subject of collective bargaining. One of the advantages of Obamacare is that if an individual becomes unemployed, let's say they were to go on strike, as an example, they and their insurance were to lapse, they could get insurance through the exchange as an individual, which would have been much more difficult before.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before the break, David, what about all these electronic healthcare records? Is one hospital going to be able to read the other ones? Are they going to be compatible?
We will soon be able to provide that service. That's already now available in Massachusetts, not because of our comprehensive health reform, but because of progressive leadership from the community here and from the state. The national government, the federal government, has created the wherewithal for what's called interoperability, in which electronic health records talk to one another. The technology is available. It needs to be accepted and implemented by providers of care. They have the capability to do that. They just have to take the initiative.
All right, we've got to take a break. We'll come back and finish up the hour talking about health care. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. My guest, Dr. Mark Siegel, Dr. Margaret Flinter, Dr. David Blumenthal. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. We'll try to dig down into some more of the details of the changing health care law as they're going to happen in 13 and 14. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the future of healthcare, the Health Care Act. Lovingly call it Obamacare. We're not trying to denigrate it, but it's what everybody calls it, so we call it also. With Dr. Mark Siegel, author of The Inner Pulse. He's also an associate professor of medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center in New York, and medical director of Doctor Radio here and medical correspondent for Fox News. Margaret Flinter, senior vice president, clinical director of Community Health Center in Middletown, Connecticut. She's a family nurse practitioner there. Dr. David Blumenthal, professor at Harvard Med School, also chief health information and innovation officer at Partners Healthcare. He's the former U.S. national coordinator for health information technology under President Obama. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You wanted to make a case?
I want to make a point. I want to throw something back to David, who, by the way, is one of the world experts on health information technology. First point, I have a two-part question for you, David. First point, your friend and my friend, Dr. Jerry Groopman, has pointed out that health information technology may not be that efficient for several years and may not actually save money. The second point is, what about competing institutions? Because we're concerned that unless there's really a national database that actually comes into play, people are going to get very territorial. Oh, you can't go to that hospital because we have all your information at our hospital, and you can't get it at the other hospital.
Competing systems.
How are we going to resolve that in the near term?
That's a great question. And we've been talking here about not electronic health records per se, but their ability to talk with one another or exchange information. And that's absolutely a vital ability of electronic health records. I'd point out that there's never going to be an opportunity to exchange information unless it's in digital form, so that in order to have exchange, you have to have electronic health records. The question then is how to get the information moving across organizations. And health information exchange is a team sport. You can't do it by yourself. You have to have a receiver down the field. If there's no one who wants to catch your information or to send it back to you, you're out of luck. This is a community problem that is inhibited by the economic incentives that cause competition in our local healthcare systems that do not value the quality and efficiency of care and do not reward people in the business of providing care for coordinating care, reducing its cost, and improving its quality. One of the most important aspects of the reforms that will take place, if we're lucky, under Obamacare or under the Affordable Care Act, is that it puts in place a whole bunch of incentives to make care better. And those incentives will have, if they are fully enforced, will create a will and a business case to use electronic health records to exchange information. But the records won't do it unless the people want to use them to do it.
Will it, Margaret, also encourage people to eat healthy, to exercise, stop smoking?
That's of course the holy grail, right? Because everything that we do in healthcare is only pales in comparison to what consumers and people can do, what parents and children and families can do by better and healthier lifestyles. But you know, the Affordable Care Act does have a provision to help with that. It's called the Community Transformation Grants, where community people come together. Such as people, one of my favorite examples is the city of Somerville, Massachusetts, to really make a healthy environment for everybody in the community, for all those things that happen outside of healthcare, particularly around safe streets, good housing, nutrition, and physical activity. But, you know, Ira, if I can just speak to two things quickly. One, just totally agreeing with what's been said about the electronic health record. We've been on a fully electronic health record for 6 or 7 years now. That is transformative in healthcare. But the other group of people that we haven't really talked to, two groups that I just want to make mention of, is one group that won't be addressed at all and is not addressed at all in the Affordable Care Act, and that's the folks living in the United States who are undocumented, which, as we know, are large numbers of people who don't get addressed in the Affordable Care Act at all. But the other that will have a better time of it, I think, are our lowest income citizens, and that's the folks who, for the first time now, when people go to the exchange to apply for insurance, the technology will be there to screen them for eligibility for Medicaid, and the limits under which people can qualify for Medicaid will have been increased, at least in most states, to 133% of the federal poverty level. And again, when you're talking about the people I've cared for all these years, people who have not had any insurance, having insurance, that's huge. And of course, we worry about the ultimate cost of all insurance, and I was very happy to see the medical loss ratio issue addressed, where 85% of the premium must be spent on health care. And also, you can't just do a 20% increase to the premiums anymore. There's some reviews and some ceilings that go with that. So thanks for letting me make those few points, too.
That's good points. Let's go to Mark in Chapel Hill. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Science Friday.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I think the elephant in the room is whether or not the profit margins in the medical industry are sustainable. Some of this discussion is always focused on patients doing with less care. What about the medical profession doing with a smaller profit margin? I have a builder friend who complained that he was losing money on houses he built because he only made $50,000 instead of $80,000. In his mind, he lost $30,000, but he actually made $50,000. What, is there any discussion about maybe reducing the profit everyone takes?
So you're saying that doctors are not going to buy into this or against this because they're going to be losing money in
their
practice?
That's what I hear. I hear that a lot about
Do you want to bring that up?
I think that brings the point up about specialists, because I've been talking mainly about primary care docs, which I am, and what I'm concerned about is exactly what the caller is saying, that specialist surgeons that put all this time into their training and have this, basically, they're more on a market situation. You want my service, you want my robotic prostate surgery, you want my skill that no one else has, you're going to have to pay for it. Psychiatrists as well. I think those people are going to go more and more outside the system and take cash only, and that undermines the whole idea of insurance expansion. Hmm.
David, do you agree?
Well, physicians in the United States are well paid. It's an attractive profession. I'm really not worried that if we reduce the rate of increase in physician compensation that we will lack for physician supply. I actually have two children who are training to be physicians, and I don't see any reduction in the interest in the medical profession. So I think that there probably is a case for reducing the rate of increase in physician compensation over time and hospital revenues over time. I think that's coming. I think it's almost inevitable. It's part of the debate that we're having in Washington right now about the fiscal cliff, because a big part of our deficit is attributable to increases in the costs of health care, not only through Medicare and Medicaid, but in the military service and in the Veterans Administration throughout.
Let me go to Jackie in Illinois. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. It's a pleasure. I am a 27-year-old, so I'm right kind of in that gap of young people that have missed out on insurance. And I live in a rural community on a pretty modest income, and I have had no medical insurance and suffered from petite mal seizures for the last 4 years. And I'm concerned that when Obamacare happens, when it goes into effect, that I will be in a place where I can't afford medical insurance, but I also can't afford to not have medical insurance because I'll be paying to have insurance and, you know, or being forced to pay to not have medical insurance. I'm just curious what you have to say about that.
Margaret Flinter?
Sure. I'd love to answer that. And, you know, first, of course, you need really good health care just for your preventive health care, but also because you've identified that you have a health condition that requires ongoing monitoring and treatment. So I would say you want to go to, and this is a great primer, the Kaiser Family Foundation allows you to kind of simulate what it's going to look like when you go to the exchange and you are able to put in your age and you're young, and that's one thing that will have a lower premium, but also your income and your family size, and will tell you how much of a subsidy you will be eligible for. And if you're under 400% of the federal poverty level, and I know that number doesn't mean anything to people as an abstraction, but you can find the information there. You're eligible for a pretty hefty subsidy. I think of it like a sliding fee scale, and I would encourage you to do that, and I'm hoping you'll find that it is affordable. And, of course, coming from the Community Health Center world, always encourage people also to look up on HRSA.gov, HRSA.gov, find a health center near you, and if you put in the county you live on, you can find a source of care on a sliding fee scale basis.
And what year does that kick in 13 or 14?
2014, January 1, 2014.
So, Jackie, you have to wait till 2014.
I happen to think...
That's all right. It's been 4 years.
Look for a community health center sooner.
Ira, I happen to think that her specific case, over the age of 26, but she can't go on her parents' policy, she actually speaks for what's good about... One of the things that's very good about Obamacare, she has a pre-existing condition. Margaret's mm-hmm. right. She can get a subsidy at an exchange. She may very well end up covered, whereas before she would have been in big trouble. I think mm-hmm. This specific group will be helped.
Mm. Margaret, we have only about a minute or two left. What are the milestones that we should expect coming up the beginning of this year and through the year and then next year?
Well, again, I think the milestones are happening on two levels. One is the development of the state-based health insurance exchanges or marketplaces. I'm proud to say here in Connecticut, we're kind of at the front of the pack on that. They have an enormous amount of work to do to build the technology, to do that screening, figure out the subsidy, vet the plans that will be in, because the insurance plans have to meet what's called the essential health benefits, which we haven't talked about, which just means it's good, high-value insurance. So that's going to go on all throughout this year. But the second piece that's running underneath it is the development of all the innovations and the models. And I don't think those are so much time-based as they are innovation-based, where people are developing the accountable care organizations and the care coordination strategies and the alternative delivery systems as well.
I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. We could talk for hours about this, and we probably will as the healthcare system rolls out. Thank you, Margaret. Dr. Margaret Flinter, Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of Community Health Center in Middletown, Connecticut. She's a family nurse practitioner there. She's also co-host of Conversations on Healthcare, a weekly radio show about health reform and innovations. David Blumenthal, professor of Harvard Med School, also Chief Health Information and Innovation Officer at Partners Healthcare, former U.S. National Coordinator for Health Information Technology under President Obama. And Dr. Mark Siegel, author of The Inner Pulse. He's also an associate professor of medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center here in New York. He's medical director of Doctor Radio, which you can hear on satellite radio, Sirius satellite radio. Also, he's a medical correspondent for Fox News. Thank you all for taking time to be with us
today. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome. Good luck to you all. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.